Josh pushed something last week, and he sort of goes, ah, oh, mea culpa, that might actually be me. I'm sorry about that. I'm sure that never happens, Josh. But
No, never.
This is the Space Dojo Show, a weekly podcast about all things JavaScript. You can find out more information at show.spacedojo.com. Enjoy the show. DigitalOcean is the best place to get your Meteor application off the ground quickly and the easiest to scale when you find success. I host Crater.io there, so I understand DigitalOcean. Start with a pre-configured one-click launch, such as Node.js, to get it up and running in 55 seconds, or build the exact infrastructure you need with root access to servers running 100% SSD in state-of-the-art data centers around the world. DigitalOcean is the fastest growing cloud infrastructure provider because it's built for developers and laser focused on its mission to create simple and elegant solutions for developers and teams. Use the promo code CRATER10 on the billing page when you sign up for $10 to get started. Welcome to the Space Dojo Show. I'm your host, Josh Owens, along with my special guest co-host today, Ben Duguid. Welcome, Ben.
Hey.
Our guest of honor today is JD Trask from Raygun. Welcome, JD.
Thank you very much for having me.
We haven't talked about it a whole lot, but I think one of the things that you have to do when you like release an app into production is have some kind of air tracking. And you are the CEO of Raygun, is that right?
That's correct. Co-founder and CEO. Yep.
So what exactly does Raygun do?
So we built Raygun a few years ago, basically to sort of scratch our own itch and also just to recognize that software faults are a big issue. I mean, our industry has been innovating at such a tremendous rate that just as soon as we get good at something, we move on to the next thing before we really, you know, dial up the quality. And I think we're starting to see a bit of a change there. I think, you know, the likes of your Googles, your Facebooks and all that are sort of setting the precedent that crappy software is a bit unacceptable. And so we built a product to do software error reporting, and it's across all platforms. There's about 20, 25 different platforms that we support, and JavaScript is obviously a really, really big one these days. So yeah, and then the company's been on a real tear since then.
Nice. Yeah. So you guys added, there's something called Pulse too, right?
Yeah. So late last year, after crash reporting had been out for a couple of years, and we'd sort of managed to get that rock solid, it's absolutely best of breed product in crash reporting. And we decided that there was a natural sort of connection to real user monitoring. It's an industry space where a real user, meaning that you're tracking the performance to your actual users. And so, you know, if you go and look at my website or my mobile app or anything like that, I want to know how long did it take you to actually load up the page and understand that the performance story there behind that. So we break that down into like the DNS time, the SSL handshake time, the how long did it take for the server to start responding, those sorts of things. It's far, far better than just doing a synthetic check from, you know, a lot of people do the whole, hey, I tested from 5 different locations or 10. But these days, that's kind of like testing data center to data center. It's not so great. That's usually over fiber optics, top quality connections between things, not really how the users are seeing things. So we've released that, and it complements the existing product. First and foremost was the web support, not the mobile stuff, and that's entirely driven off our JavaScript library as well.
So with the real user monitoring, like, you know, I've done where you install something on the server and it's kind of looking at response times as far as like returning queries from the database and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The real user monitor is like more of a client side. Like it's like you're getting all that information from the browser. Like once the user connects and everything, like the browser can tell you all that information.
Yeah. So take, for example, a modern web application. If I'm strictly using an APM tool that's tracking things on the server and it says, oh yeah, we ran these 3 queries, they took this long and the server generation took this long and then we returned it. That is useful information to a developer, specifically a backend developer. But what it doesn't tell you necessarily is that the user requested, say, slash maybe the root of an application, and it first loaded the page, and let's say it was a single page application. So it made the first request, then it fires off some AJAX calls to fetch other blocks and load them in there and all of that. And that might also have some server side impact. But effectively at the end of the day, we sometimes forget we're building software for other humans. All that matters is how quickly does the page load for my user? How much satisfaction are they getting? And I think sometimes we can lose sight of that as engineers. We love the code. We love the tools we're working with. But at the end of the day, it's the users, not whether a query took a certain length of time on one request.
Coming from, like, I've spent the last couple of years at Meteor, and like, they don't have a way to split up a code base, like the JavaScript, the minified JavaScript file. And so, like, if you connect to Crater, you're sending like 2 megs of JavaScript over before the application can really work. And yeah, even in the US, that can be a little bit slow, but, you know, I think it's interesting to be able to figure out that it's like running really slow for people that might be in another country and you don't even realize it.
Well, there's other countries, and there's also the rise of mobile, where even if you're in America, and I mean, incidentally, I seem to get a better 4G connection in when I'm in our New Zealand office than I do over here, I assume just because it's less congested over there. But, you know, we break down that story within our real user monitor and say, well, how does it compare between a mobile connection and a sort of fixed line? Because, yeah, I could be in America and have a 2 meg download. And if I'm connected to a congested tower, that could take a really long time to potentially load up on a mobile device. And with the rise of your tablets, even some laptops now coming with actual integration with cell networks, you never really know when somebody could be loading over those connections.
You guys provide all these feedback and these kind of analytics of, you know, what real users are experiencing. Do you guys, let's say, you know, if I'm a customer using Raygun or using Pulse, I received this analytics and I don't know what to do. Do you guys provide like prescriptive like feedback, that type of thing?
Yes and no. So in the no round, so when we first released the product late last year, we would record everything so we can give you the waterfalls on loads. We can tell you the assets that are slow, those sorts of things. And on the yes side is that we are just about, I think next week we're running and internally releasing an extension to the product called Pulse Insights. And it's a free add-on for our existing users. And what it does is we collect all of the data from the end users who are doing things. And that effectively gives us this corpus of URLs within the site. And now, obviously, V1, this works only on public-facing pages, but we then go out and crawl it, and we run things like the Google page speed and why slow type rules on pages. Okay. And when we do that, the plus side of it is I'm sure you guys are aware, if you're diagnosing a software issue on a given page, you will go and run it through page speed or something and go, oh, okay, yeah, I've done this and there's no cache headers and whatnot. That's still single page specific, right? So what we wanted to do was say, well, we'll try and scan all the pages we can, and then we can say to you something like, hey, Ben, you know, this page is slow. Here's the rules that were broken. And when you're trying to prioritize that, you might sort of say, well, actually, this rule is universally broken across your site. If you take the time to fix this, you're going to actually have a positive impact across all of the pages on your site, which I think is a lot more helpful. So that's where it's becoming a stronger yes, that we are trying to give people help. And I think that is actually where we're getting to the next stage of these sorts of tools for people, is a lot of them I considered sort of stargazing, data porn type products. You know, take Google Analytics. I always have to remember to go and look at that thing because it never reaches out and tells me something abnormal happened. It doesn't tell me how to resolve things really. And I believe that the second wave of things actually saying, hey, you should do this, or this thing blew up, go and take this action, is becoming what people are expecting now.
Yeah, I think the push model is really cool. You see all these Slack bots and Slack ops and chat ops and all these things. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that Slack and HipChat are our top two integrations with Raygun for pumping in messages to the team. You know, we do email as well, obviously, but we've seen a real decline in the people wanting those, because you'll get something like, take the error monitoring, error pops in there. You know, the whole team kind of sees it, and then they can have that discussion around it, and it'll be like, you know what? Josh pushed something last week and he sort of goes, mea culpa, that might actually be me. I'm sorry about that. I'm sure that never happens, Josh. But
No, never. Totally. Yeah. If you look at the old Amazon story of like 100 milliseconds equates to like $1 million or something like that, tools like this kind of matter, because I was reading something, it might have been one of your guys' tweets or something, but like, people don't come back. They rarely come back a second or third time when an app isn't working, you know, and that first impression matters, that speed matters. So I think this stuff's like hugely important and undervalued a lot. Like people don't think about it when they're deploying, and this stuff's pretty easy to add on.
I think you're bang on. I mean, there is the performance. The thing that sort of blows my mind a wee bit is still the error tracking, because that's been even less adopted than performance monitoring. And what we found when we instrumented our own existing software was you'd maybe get 1% of your users ever tell you something went wrong. And then your chance of actually being able to resolve that on, you know, depending on the audience, can be pretty low. You know, it's kind of like saying people might not fly somewhere if the plane, you know, takes too long to get there. They definitely won't fly somewhere if the plane blows up. You know, it's like, I think crash reporting is massively undervalued. And then secondly, performance is largely undervalued because it usually takes companies to get to the size that they have data scientists that start waving their arms to say, hey, we've tracked this. And this sort of philosophical rant that I'll try and not go on here, but largely that as technologists and development folks, I don't think a lot of us have earned the right yet to or behave in a way that actually gets us to sit at the decision-making table, because we don't raise these things. We let things go way too far before we say, actually, we should have this sort of monitoring. I can give you this sort of feedback. And here's the data or the story that dials back to why it's good for our customers, why it's good for our business. We do tend to focus a little too heavily on just what we have in front of us right now and what we're working on. And I think we've got to change that in the industry.
Yeah, so I think, like you were saying, just the idea of error tracking is really undervalued, which is strange because, yeah, stuff is breaking. People should know. So you guys do track errors. What about custom, like, logging messages? Or I wanted to just log certain things myself.
So you can always throw an error with some sort of details if you want. A common one that we have that people use is validation frameworks, where they want to record how often people are failing validation, but they don't necessarily want it to be a full-on crash report. So we have the ability to sort of split between the two, because we can give you the data, like what percentage of your users actually have a crash or an error. And you don't want to necessarily say that just because they had a validation failure that counted as an error, but you want to know about those. So you can actually send data to us that way. Secondly, you can tag any of the data that you send to us to do filtering. And then lastly, you can also attach custom data, which could be anything you want. It could be binary. It could be another JSON blob. It can be whatever's useful to your business to help you diagnose things. So an example of this might be, we have a user at the moment who's testing the software that uses a calculator to help their customers understand their pricing. And they know that they have issues with that. And so what they want to do is they want to actually attach the model that they've assigned to the calculator to any error reports that are triggered, so that when their team is looking at it, they can kind of go, oh, okay, we're mishandling this particular format or version of the model that might have been installed by the client, those sorts of things. So we're trying to give everything we can to people. We also store all of the data. It's not just an aggregated line of error rates. It's like, hey, look, here's piles of data. And the thing I always chuckle about with that is one of our highest feature requests is, please give me a CSV export. And, you know, you turn around and point out to somebody that you actually have 80 gigs of data for them. And it's probably not going to suit a CSV. And that's like, oh, yeah, actually, I haven't thought about how much data this can stack up to. But, I mean, the great thing with error reporting, you talk about, you know, being undervalued. We sometimes have these discussions with somebody, usually smaller companies, where they'll say, hey, you know, we don't think that this should cost, you know, we should be paying, say, a few hundred dollars for this. And again, this comes back to that developer maturity thing where it's like, well, do you think that the bigger cost to your business is the $300 or the 400,000 unhandled errors that you have a month? You know, like, I'm pretty sure the latter is going to be harming you a lot more. And you could be making a lot more money, giving users a much better experience if you actually just went through and resolved some of the problems.
The other thing that's like sometimes helpful too is if you are getting like 400,000 errors to your inbox or something, like, it looks like you guys have some kind of like intelligent grouping or smart grouping, so that, like, I remember back to the days of Rails and using I think there was an open source error tracker you could add on, and like it would just send you an email every time there was an error. Didn't matter if you'd already seen it. It's like when you have 200,000 people hitting your site in a day. Like that's really, yeah. really terrible to get that in your head.
Absolutely. So what we do is we do a sort of a fingerprint on each hero that comes through. We then roll it up. There's also some options to customize the grouping if you don't like how we do it by default. But by default, we have a pretty good grouper. And then what we do is we'll send you an email or post into your Slack or however you want to configure it. And we'll say, hey, Josh, we just saw this error occur. It's brand new. You should probably go look at it. And then we monitor that for about 2 minutes. So we see if more errors that match that fingerprint come through. And if they do, we'll do a follow-up with you and say, hey, Josh, it's been 2 minutes. This error's occurred another 13,000 times and the rate's accelerating. You should really go and look at this. And then we repeat that at the 5, 10, and 30-minute mark. And that has worked tremendously well for saving somebody's inbox. They get the rate, the trends, all of that, but they're not getting drowned in it. And this kind of comes back a little bit to when we first looked at building Raygun, was I reflect on my time working in an IT services company where the good developers, they would write their own little exception handler, which would usually email themselves. And showing my age a little bit, this was the days of you had a 10 megabyte inbox, so you deploy something that was crap and suddenly no more email for you. But the big challenge was that once you had that volume as well, you started to train yourself not to look at it because it was usually noise, not signal. So we have all these things in there to say permanently ignore certain errors. As you guys will be well aware, the browser is a pretty hostile environment in which to operate. So there's a lot of things that we'll report on and you can permanently ignore so it won't count towards processing quota. We won't bug you about. You don't want to see it because you can't fix it. I mean, a classic case is the Chrome browser extensions that run inside the same scope as the JavaScript on the page. So occasionally you get an error and be like, what's this talking about 1Password for? Oh, it's the extension had an error. Turn that off because I can't fix that. Those sorts of things. So yeah, I mean, trying to make sure that you're giving people only information when they should take an action or at least seems important so they can choose to take an action, I think is one of the keys to success in any sort of product for sort of DevOps.
I'm kind of curious, I was just looking over the features and you have integration for GitHub and Bitbucket. Do you guys use source maps or deminify a file? I guess you can't really do that, but somehow you're able to tie hey, this code broke here and here's the line of code in GitHub. Yeah. Do you have that feature?
Yeah, so what we do is, so in terms of source maps, we support our customers having source maps. We have quite a few guides on building source maps, and we've even recently put up our own source map validator because I think a lot of people are only just discovering source maps and seeing the value of them. And mm-hmm. I know that source maps kind of have come out almost as a de facto standard rather than a hardcore, planned standard as such. And that has led to there being quite a lot of different ways of approaching source maps. So we've supported them for ages and we support several different models of that too, where we receive an error. We know the JavaScript file, we'll go look for a map file and see if we can automatically fetch it. We'll check in the JavaScript file to see, we might pull that to see if we can find the actual reference to the map file, which is another way of doing it. We also support uploading it to us manually so you can have private source maps. Generally, I feel like that's a little bit of the old security through obscurity. But, a lot of people seem to like being able to post the source maps to us for our private processing. So that stuff all works. And then because we have the JavaScript file, we will automatically try and put the code once it's been processed by the source map processor in there so you can see the code in line with what was going on with the stack trace. So that'll happen regardless of the source control integration. Source control integration is more about being able to create, say, a GitHub issue directly from Raygun referencing the issue details or connect it to an existing issue in GitHub, Bitbucket, Visual Studio Online. And then secondly, we have a deployment tracking system so you can actually ping us so we can start telling you which deployments had what sort of health characteristics. So error rates went up, new errors introduced by this deployment, these things reoccurred. And with that, you can put the Git hash on there and we'll go through and pull the commit details so you could actually go in and have a look and say, oh, right, this actually rolled up all of these code changes. This looks like it shouldn't have been in there maybe. that could be the issue. So the integrations are kind of multifaceted when you talk about Bitbucket and GitHub. We have also just added GitLab integration, since that's the cool kid on the block these days.
You know, you hear stories about places like actually GitHub, and when they deploy their code, like they do almost like a soft deploy, and they'll watch errors for the first 10 minutes. And if they rise, like they'll auto roll it back and like notify the person that had code in those commits, like maybe there was something wrong. So I guess you could almost build something like that with Raygun, maybe?
Absolutely. So we have good friends at Octopus Deploy. So they build a deployment system for usually .NET apps, but really you could probably get anything in there. And we've been sort of talking with them over time about the idea of actually integrating with a deployment system so that we can ping the rate information to say, yeah, this went too high, automatically roll back a deployment. The only wrinkle you run into that is you kind of want to ignore the first 1 minute, because oftentimes when you change things over, there can be a spike. But that following 9 minutes, for example, should be pretty calm. And that's the thing that we're trying to do. I think GitHub have a fantastic engineering blog where they talk about this stuff. But frankly, you know, not every company has the engineering capability of, say, a Facebook, a Google, a GitHub, these big companies that are really focused on it. So we want to try and make our tools available to everybody else to achieve a similar outcome.
Do you guys provide like webhooks too? So let's say if I wanted to roll my own kind of deployment monitoring system, if you could just, you know, receive all of the errors and then go, okay, like on my end, I would just reverse the deployment based on that.
Yeah. So we do have webhooks, so you can hook up to them. We recently also made it so you can register multiple webhook endpoints, so that was originally just one. So we're always improving that. And we're also looking at additional webhooks for various events and things. We do have at the moment one. We're working on the ability to do that around a deployment, so that if a new error occurs, you can sort of identify who the person was that did the deployment to alert them to it. That sort of scenario is becoming quite popular now. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm seeing there's an API actually, so you can just post your deployment yourself and you just give it like the API key and a couple other pieces of information.
Yeah, it's a pretty simplistic way of registering a deployment. But the nice thing about that is if you were to get started, you can actually kind of go through and backfill your deployments if you were that keen on it. It also gives you a nice pretty chart as well of the cadence of your deployments, because something like Raygun really helps, I believe, in helping businesses adopt that sort of continuous deployment model, because you've got this sort of safety net, if you will. You know, that's usually when you talk to people about why do you have a monthly release cycle or a 2-weekly release cycle, and it's out of fear they're going to break stuff. And it's like, well, if you can deploy it, see the error come through, fix it in like 10 minutes, redeploy 10 minutes later, or roll back while you do the deployment, you know, that's pretty cool. So we have this real user monitoring thing, but you can identify your users if you want. So let's say we do this with Raygun itself. If we want to identify the user who's logged in, we provide an email address and their name. And that gives me a view then of all of the users of our system. I can see all of the errors tied back to those users, and I can see the performance data about that user. Great thing about that is I can see somebody has an issue and we fix it. I can actually contact those people and say, hey, we're really sorry about that problem you had. It's now been resolved. Go back and try again. You want to see a way of turning an at-risk user who's not having a good time into a huge advocate? You do that. You know, that it blows people's minds. They're so trained to get the Microsoft Word stop responding. You want to send this to Microsoft, and you're like, well, the first 10 times didn't work, so why would I? But you imagine if you got an email from Microsoft the next day saying, you know, hey, Ben, we saw that Word crash yesterday. There's going to be a hot fix out next week that'll solve that. You kind of go, holy like, that's a totally different dynamic, you know?
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah. I saw that in the features and was going to ask you, because I think that is killer from a user experience standpoint.
It's a pretty big deal. Some companies, obviously, due to their privacy policies, can't use it in that way. What we have seen people do, though, is say, rather than give an email address, they can put in any identifier. So some of them will put in a primary key for the user in their database. So if they ever need to go and find out who it was, they can, but it means nothing to us, which is a great halfway house for protecting the user identity, but being able to track it back to your own users.
And then you can still do all the pulse, like that goes for both pulse and the error tracking, correct?
Oh yeah, yeah. So the way we have the crash reporting, we have pulse, and they're both, you know, paid for products. And then we have the users and the deployments. And I like to think of them as being sort of the horizontal products, if you will, where the more things you put on top, the more we can light things up. So like deployments, did the performance change? Did the errors go up? Users, okay, what crashes for them, what performance story. And then whatever we bring out on the platform down the track will ultimately light that up further and further. So it's the piece of the product that just gets more and more and more valuable the more bits you put on top of it.
I've got another question. You mentioned Google Analytics earlier and how it's like the pull model. You have to go there to see things yourself and they don't tell you when things are happening. And this user tracking, but like what else differentiates you from Google Analytics as far as...
Well, I think there's an element where large companies understand real user monitoring because it's been a tool around for a little while. So to them, they already know what to look for that's different. For people that are just approaching it, it does look a lot like an analytics product, but it's not. It just happens that because you collect a lot of the same data, you can provide that, like the browsers, the platforms, the user journeys, those things. Where real user monitoring does stand on its own is around that performance story and being able to slice and dice it by, say, geo data. And maybe you find that the transfer time to, say, your customers in Europe is taking too long. So you want to maybe set up a data center over there or, you know, use a cloud provider there to make it quicker. We also collect, you'll be aware, you know, when you go into Google Chrome and you look at the whole waterfall model, of what, how the page load. So we collect that on every single page as the users go through, and we can present that back and we can show you the median, the average, the P90s, the P99s, give you that distribution of how the performance is working in there. So that's super useful. And that's actually the big core difference from being a Google Analytics type product. So it just happens that we have some of their data as well. Probably won't last forever, but the other benefits that we have over that is that, one, we're not script blocked yet, like we're not part of anybody trying to screen that out, and secondly, we have developed the system so that you can self-host our JavaScript. So I remember there was a Hacker News article a while ago about self-hosting your analytics, and people kind of were like, yeah, you get better data, but it is a royal hassle having to run your own analytics system. Well, with us, you'd have the benefit that you could self-host the JavaScript and just have it in with yours, and you know, you can report on that and still get all the benefits of a hosted system without the blocking.
You do error tracking on both the server and the client, is that right?
We can do error tracking on the server, the client, mobile apps with our native web, everything. So we've kind of got, we've got the crash reporting space pretty well covered.
So primarily the listeners here are JavaScript. A lot of them came from a Meteor background. I actually did a little bit of research before the show and found someone actually has a Meteor package that integrates Raygun. So that's kind of cool.
That's neat.
Do you, like, what other kind of front ends do you have packages for? Or do I just install your script and I don't have to worry if I'm using React or Angular?
You usually don't have to worry too much about the front-end stuff. We have put handling in there for specific scenarios, like I think jQuery from memory did some things where it was wrapping the AJAX calls that would by default mean that we weren't able to record them as well with the stock standard capability. But the nice thing is with JavaScript being such a flexible language, that we could actually put things in there to look for those and not necessarily have to A, bloat the library too much, or B, sort of have these crazy dependencies going on. So that's been useful. There is the stock standard scenario where, for example, we can plug in and collect errors pretty well. But if you're using the real user monitoring, because you don't have the same sort of page view system where you're not getting the request response type behavior because you've got a single page app, there can sometimes be a little bit of customization. I like to joke that maybe you have to put in a second line to do the integration, usually into your router or router, as you might call it over here, to make sure that we record those events of navigation. Since, you know, in a single page app, normally it's just a sort of a DOM event, really. Sometimes it's not even got a request going on. We do track the AJAX stuff automatically, but to actually say, hey, they viewed this page when it wasn't really a page, that does require a little bit of instrumentation, but not a lot. I mean, it's effectively the same as what you'd have to do with a Google Analytics or any other framework, tool that you're doing for tracking.
The big thing now is like React Native and Native Script, and like some people are doing Cordova as well. Like, can I just still use the JavaScript package for that, or do I need to use something else?
So we have customers that are working with Cordova and the Raygun for JS package comfortably. I haven't seen too much around Native Script, or I think we have had somebody ask about React Native, but to be honest, there hasn't been the demand yet for it. One of the things that is important to note, though, is that our providers are all open source on GitHub. So we like to work with people on that stuff. So I always encourage folks to say, hey, if you wanted to get it working with one of these, I'm happy to allocate engineering time at our end to working with you to make sure that works. But I've never been a big fan of us trying to develop support for a framework that we're not using ourselves and just doing a half-assed job at it. That's our sort of way forward for some of those things as they emerge.
Gotcha. So you mentioned HTTP requests and kind of just understanding how they work and the whole request response model. But with WebSockets, is it a similar story there, or do you have to manually call out to Raygun?
WebSockets are definitely a bit more involved again for that. So we use WebSockets in the Pulse UI, and so we use Pulse ourselves to track our own product, and that scenario for when you're just feeding data in and out, that gets quite messy, especially because they're often sort of a live connection as such where you're feeding data through. So like in Pulse, you've got the live page where we show you the activity around the world that's occurring on your website and the data's going down, it is just an active connection. You're not actually saying that it started and it ended. You're kind of just wanting to almost track, was there any activity, or maybe was there a forced close event? So what we have done so far is we actually just record almost as an error if the connection is not available and there's a fault from the server side to trying to connect to the end user, which has proven to be, it's a challenging area to work on because you do run into the situation where you have things like browsers where, say, you change to another tab and sort of it, you know, the browser will basically power down a range of features, often including the WebSocket capability, where you lose the connection. So some of those things become messy to try and manage. So in general, I'd say best support is standard HTTP requests. Good support is your modern SPA support where it's using AJAX calls. Weaker support is WebSockets, just because they are fiddly and used in so many different ways by people. If you have a great idea on how to handle that in a generic way for people, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you are using Node, so if you're running JavaScript on the server and the client, you might be able to intelligently pay attention, but it'd be pretty hard to do it generically.
Yeah, and we do have a Node provider specifically written for Node, so it'll try and pick up other things in the crash reporting side anyway. It'll look at things like the CPU, available memory, things like that that might have been causing errors. Again, testament to the flexibility of JavaScript is that occasionally we run into people who have set up their Node stuff using the JavaScript provider rather than the Node-specific one. It all works. We've definitely got a lot of people using Node with it, and we use Node ourselves as part of our API layer.
Is there any like performance costs of tracking all the data? I know you said you guys are capturing the Chrome graphs and stuff for everything. Yeah. I imagine there'd be slight, but it's probably...
It's pretty negligible. So what we've done is... So one, in crash reporting, the overhead is basically naught unless you're throwing a lot of errors, because we by default are going to be listening for the unhandled exception event, which means that there's the cost of wiring onto an event, which is basically nothing. And then if there are a lot of problems, yeah, that's going to generate some volume. But we make sure that we are defensive about all of this. So for example, wherever possible, and this is just generically not JavaScript, but we will always try and make sure we do things asynchronously. We make sure that we're aware that the internet may not be available. Even in the JavaScript provider, it's got the smarts to say, no, I'm not actually connected right now. Maybe park this in local storage to try and send later. We also make sure that that's a rotating log, so we don't just fill up all your local storage with an infinite loop error, those sorts of things. So we try to do our best to be a really great sort of citizen inside your app fully aware that it's actually a it's an honor that customers will have us executing in their app, and we need to respect that the whole way. So I don't think we've ever actually had anybody have an issue with the overhead of things. In the Pulse side, we do collect up those stats in a similar way, that they're designed to send at the end. They're as asynchronous as we can possibly make them. You know, if they do fail, they'll fail silently, those sorts of things. We've also worked pretty hard to minimize the actual size of the blob. So if you looked at it, you know, in the Chrome dev tools, you'd see that everything's been renamed down to like one letter properties that we then turn into the proper stuff at our end. But yeah.
Nice. Yeah. I've definitely like run into that before. I worked on another project where they were having performance issues and they had a performance tracker installed on the server side. And the thought was that it was causing additional performance problems, but we couldn't pinpoint it. And so they just removed it. But then at that point we didn't have any metrics, so we couldn't prove that it got better.
Yeah, so that's a big challenge in the APM world, where you install an agent on a box. And the reason that that's usually very expensive, and it depends very much on the language that you're targeting. Like some languages are very friendly to being profiled, and some just, you might as well throw away half your CPU to just profiling it. We've seen that. We think that we don't do APM. But what we see there is, I'm not sure why people necessarily run it so much, given the overhead of some of the languages. I think it could be done a lot better. We ran into a similar thing where we found a provider out there where they more or less removed the timings from their own recorder, so that if you're looking at the stats, you kind of go, oh, okay, there was no performance overhead of our bits, but actually, wait a minute, how could there never be any overhead? That doesn't make any sense. It must be getting removed. So that was worrying. That is a really hard space to work in, because you're saying we want to monitor performance, and in order to do that, we want to take some of your performance. Balancing act.
Do you guys have any cool zero to hero case studies where people didn't know they were throwing thousands of errors? And
oh yeah, yeah. I mean, so we've the classic thing that happens with everybody, and forewarning to anybody coming and looking at our product, is everybody thinks they're a small plan. They go, oh, 25,000 errors a month. There's no way I generate that. It's like, there's a reason it's called the small plan, and it ain't because it's super common to be less than 25,000. You don't have to be big for that. And so, one, that blows people away. We've had one customer who has 2/3 the active user base of Twitter, and they did a mass deployment of their entire app, V2, and they were generating 110,000 exceptions per second that we managed to auto-scale and handle pretty well. Those emails doing the roll-up saying that the rates were high, pretty obvious. The most common thing we run into is people say, I put this in, I was blown away by how many faults there were. I then managed to reduce our error rate by, say, 80% in like 3 weeks. This was a huge win for us, and now we don't know how we ever operated without a tool like that. That's like the canonical user case. And in terms of people even leaving the service, we don't really get people leaving unless their business fails, like they're a startup that was looking at things, because once you've actually had that data, why would you ever want to fly blind again?
I'm kind of curious, like we've talked a lot about the product, but I'm curious what your stack looks like too, because I know that like dealing with a lot of incoming error data or a lot of incoming metric data, like requires actually quite a bit of scaling once you reach a certain amount of people. What kind of stack are you using to like run the app and handle the front end, that kind of stuff?
The API nodes are presently running in Node.js. We're actually a fairly big Microsoft dev house. So the web app is written in ASP.NET MVC. It uses Marionette and Backbone on the front end. We've got multiple different data stores in there across MySQL, Postgres, Elasticsearch, Redis, you know, effectively different layers of caching, hot data, warm data, cold data. We wrote our own storage engine last year, which has massively improved our ability to deal with the volumes of data that we have, because our belief is that we need to store the raw data because when our customers are trying to solve something, they actually want to go through that. And secondly, they often want to export the data and do their own analysis. So if all we've done is taken the data and done some aggregations and given you a pretty picture, that's not going to help you actually fix things. And so we've got that in there, which is, like I said, it's fairly bespoke. It has a lot of similarities probably to the Hadoop file system project, if you're aware of that one, where, you know, we bring data together, we do collect some aggregate information, and then we have those caching layers to minimize the number of writes and things. We also have some Go in the mix there. So for iOS crashes, because we do support iOS natively, you have to run what's called a symbolification process to turn the stack traces from effectively like unreadable hex addresses and memory back into a human readable stack trace. And so we orchestrate all of that with Go on some Mac boxes running the desymbolification process, well, the symbolification process. So it's a bit of a mix. And I think that that's a fairly common thing we see these days, is the sort of polyglot setups, even in smaller companies, where people are now sort of picking the better tool for the job. You know, I saw you retweeted, Josh, the other day, somebody saying that, you know, if you have to, I'll butcher the quote, but if you have to crap all over the previous language you learned as a reason for adopting the newest one. And it's like, it's kind of like imagining somebody, a carpenter or someone, going, hey, you know what, I've learned how to use a saw, so all axes are now, you know. And it's like, no, actually everything kind of has its strengths and its weaknesses. You need to find out where it works best for you. So yeah, that's why we've ended up with different bits and pieces in different places.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I used to do a podcast where I talked to people like GitHub, or I don't think I ever got anyone from Twitter, but like we would just talk about like their stack and how it was set up. And like any company that had to scale beyond maybe 10, 15 employees and like, you know, a couple thousand, 20,000 users, like at some point they end up leaving this idea of like, we just have this one technology managing everything.
Yeah.
They end up moving into this like hybrid, like we just got to do what's best and what makes the most sense. Like, you know.
Well, I think that's an underpinning driver, along with many others, for some of the movement towards microservices. I'm not really a big fan of the term microservices. I just think making services, you know, like if anything, microservices is just the, you know, the new way of talking about service-oriented architecture. But the idea that you say, we have an API of some sort, you don't have to care what it's written in behind the scenes. That mm-hmm. team needs to know that. And who, you know, they've picked the best thing for them, which might be just that that's their skill set, or it might be that it's the best language for that particular capability. And that's useful in growing teams.
To me, like, I'm super interested in GraphQL for that exact reason. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, it's that smart disconnect point between the front end and the back end, where you don't have to care about, like, you know, you can use any database behind a resolver and it just, yeah, it knows how to get its data and return it to you. And like, you can figure out behind the scenes how to scale that resolver. So
yeah, absolutely.
Excited for GraphQL.
Me too.
It's funny. It's, interestingly, with anything around, whether graph database or that, I see people when they start playing with these things, they either don't get it, or they're like, "Oh my god, this is the coolest thing I've ever played with." You know.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're at the end of our time here. Thanks for coming on the show, JD.
No, it's been a real pleasure. Great to chat with both you and Ben.
Yeah. So real quick, before we do our picks, where can people find out more info about Raygun?
So we are at raygun.com, RAYGUN.com. We're also on Twitter as at raygun.io. So we recently changed from raygun.io being the domain to the .com. And if people want to ping me directly on anything, I'm TraskJD on Twitter. So TraskJD.
Nice.
Cool.
Yes. So every time we do one of these shows, at the end, we just go through and do like a pick. It can be one pick. If there's more than one, like, feel free to say that too. But it doesn't have to be tech related. If it is, that's okay. But, you know, just something that's been improving your life in some way.
Yeah. Well, it's slightly nerdy, but I recently got a The Oculus Rift. I was one of the original backers, so they sent me one for free, which was very, very nice of them. And I have 25 odd years of coding behind me, but I've been playing with this stuff, and I just think, you know, it is super early on. It is super early on, but I've got a feeling that like this is the next biggish thing that's going to happen. I could see a lot of stuff moving into VR. A lot of people at the moment don't think it's there, and I feel like that's the same sort of vibe that you got with people with the internet probably in about like 94. You know, it was like, oh yeah, there's some gimmicky tricks here, and I can, yeah. But it's like this thing is pretty cool, and the extra bits of tech that they keep putting in there. So I've got the DK1, now it's on the Rift, and it's got that sort of the depth perception where I can move my hand. That's tripping me out. I'm loving that. I'm super excited to see what happens there.
My coworker's got the HTC Vive, and it's just like you put it on and it just blows your mind. Like, yeah. That's all they talk about.
Almost everybody that I talk to, if I say this thing's going to like change the world down the track, like not this version, but the trend. And when I talk to somebody and they go, yeah, I'm like, have you tried any of these? No. And I'm like, there's the problem. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, that's my pick. It is a bit geeky, but it's cool. Anyway, definitely. Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Do I go? Is it my turn?
Yeah. Go ahead, Ben.
All right. So I've got a couple. My fiance is my first pick, holding us down. I'm getting married in December. Pretty excited.
Awesome, man.
So that's exciting. And, my second pick is this. There's this article, I can dig it up, but full stack Redux. Like, we've been doing a lot of Redux on the client, and we're doing this crazy cool microservice architecture where you have each node has its own Redux store on the back end, and there's like a bunch of nodes. So it's super interesting, but this is a good, really good tutorial on getting up and running with that. So
cool.
Nice. I'm going to have to go with the Apple Watch. Like, I was not originally sold on it. Like, I've actually had it for a while, but I don't know. I went running the other day. So I've committed to try to run every day at this point. And my phone had died. And usually, like, if my phone's dead, like, I'll just be like, oh, I'm not going to run because I can't track how I did, which may be stupid. But it turns out, like, I used the Apple Watch instead, and like it tracked the run just fine. Actually, it was pretty, since I track my run every day and I tend to run the same route, like I know roughly where a mile is, and like it dinged me within a couple feet of what my phone thinks is a mile. So I was quite impressed, even without a phone, like how accurate it seems to be. So I'm starting to dig the Apple Watch, and I'm excited for Apple Watch OS 3. So.
Yeah, that looks like they resolve a lot of the shortcomings, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Because like it's so frustrating to try to spin up an application or something and it just sits there like spinning.
Yeah.
It's terrible. So I'm kind of excited for an instant launch.
We should build performance tracking for Apple Watch.
totally, because it's terrible right now. Like,
yeah, well,
everyone knows their apps are terrible, but like there's not much they can do about it. So
yeah.
maybe it'll get better. You know?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show, JD. Really appreciate it.
It's been great. Thank you.
Yeah. And as always, big thanks to the sponsor, DigitalOcean. If you need hosting, you can check them out, digitalocean.com. And if you enjoy these shows, you can go to Patreon too, patreon.com/MeteorClub, and you can subscribe there and help support the show. So, all right, guys. See you next time.
See ya.
Bye.
This has been a Space Dojo production. You can find out more information about Space Dojo at spacedojo.com. It's easy to join the mailing list and stay in the loop. That's SPACEDOJO.com.